Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Kara Hetland, and our coverage of the upcoming execution of Charles Rhines continues. The Cornell Death Penalty Project is dedicated to neutral examination of how the death penalty operates. And every year, project staff produce a number of articles related to the death penalty. Areas of particular interest to the project include race and the death penalty, mental impairment and the death penalty, and the law of federal habeas corpus. There is no litmus test for students who work on the project's cases or research projects. And John Bloom is the director of the Cornell Death Penalty Project. He's a graduate of the Yale Law School and former director of the South Carolina Death Penalty Resource Center. Mr. Bloom has been counsel of record in numerous capital cases argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, the Federal Courts of Appeal, and state Supreme Courts. And we welcome him to In the Moment as he joins us from Ithaca, New York. John Bloom, welcome to In the Moment.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So I summarized what you do, but really there's so much more.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit. Are you following the Charles Rhines case in South Dakota?
I'm not necessarily intimately familiar with everything that's been happening in the case, but I know he's got an execution date. I know that one of the big issues in the case had to do with whether he was sentenced to death because of his sexual orientation.
So that was resolved and said that that's not really an issue. Should that be an issue? And I think it stemmed really from juror questions to the judge.
Well, I mean, it's without knowing exactly what the proof was, what I read was that a number of the jurors had come forward and signed affidavits indicating that they thought that a life sentence really wasn't going to be a sufficient punishment for Mr. Rhines because he would be in an all-male prison and would thus be able to continue on with his, quote, lifestyle, close quotes. So.
Is that worth the battle over the execution? Is that worth an appeal?
Well, it is, troubling. The role of the jury in a capital sentencing case is to make a reasoned moral response about what the appropriate punishment would be. And if they are making it because it's distorted either bias against gay people or because they don't think that a life sentence is going to be sufficient enough, then there is a question about whether the jury performed its intended role in the overall process here.
So let's talk a little bit about public opinion overall on capital punishment. And is this shifting?
Yes, it's over the last really decade or so, there's been a fairly significant shift in the number of new death sentences imposed, the number of executions, and polling data on public support for the death penalty. The sort of the high watermark over the last 50 years or so would have been like the late 1980s, early 1990s. Since then, there's been a decline, but really the last decade, there's been a steep decline in death sentences, executions, and public support for capital punishment.
And so what, 21 states have repealed capital punishment, yes?
Yes. Yes, I mean the numbers continue to shrink, and then you also have a number of other states where they technically have it on the books, but they're not really using it, or they've got no one or almost anyone on death row. So there are a number of almost there's de jure, I mean states which have formally done away with it, and then a number of other states in which it's there on the books, but it's not really being used.
And is there a specific type of crime that it would get used more often than not?
Well, you still see it being sought in cases that where there are a significant number of people that are killed. I mean, for example, the Charleston, South Carolina church shooting when Dylan Roof went into the church and shot a number. So you see it in cases like that being used. You do see it in some places being used for what, seems to be not that egregious a homicide. I mean, one of the issues with the death penalty is it's It's even sort of a mistake in some ways to talk about like the death penalty in Texas or a particular state, because the decision whether to seek it or not is really left up to individual prosecutors. So, you know, even in states like my home state of South Carolina, there are 44 counties in the state. Well, 22 of them have never sentenced anyone to death in the last 100 years. So, you know, it's very much of a not only is it a state by state issue, it's also, you know, county by county or jurisdiction by jurisdiction.
So then let's talk a little bit about how the choice is made for capital punishment in regards to the victims' families. How much say do they really have?
In most states they don't have any formal role in the process. I mean, many states have Victims' Bill of Rights, which, you know, require prosecutors to consult with victims about potential outcomes and plea offers or what they're going to charge with. But they don't have any, you know, official role in the proceedings. That being said, I think the desires of a victim's family do play a significant role in the decision whether to seek the death penalty and also in the decision whether to stay or go forward with an execution when one is scheduled.
Because if their wish is to not proceed with the death penalty, they 9 times out of 10, they listen?
I think if they're not, if they're opposed to it, then certainly in the overwhelming percentage of cases, not always, you know, the prosecutors listen to that and decide not to seek the death penalty. Because it can, for a family that doesn't want it, it can be traumatic for the prosecution to go through a capital trial and to have someone sentenced to death, sort of in their name, so to speak. So, you know, victims, I think, are still fairly significant players in the system.
What role does religion play
in the decision whether to impose the death penalty or to seek it?
All of the above.
It can play a significant role. It depends. I mean, we're not nearly as probably religious a country as we once were, and certainly young people don't seem to embrace organized religion in the same numbers that people of my generation did and do. But it can be, in certain regions of the country, for example, in the South is much more sort of evangelically oriented than that. Than many other parts of the country, it can play a significant role in jurors' attitudes, potential jurors' attitudes about the death penalty. You know, you've also had prosecutors who, for example, were either strict Catholics or devout Catholics and didn't really believe in the death penalty because of their own religious beliefs. And so they can't necessarily seek it or not seek it because of that, but it can play a significant factor.
Talk a little bit in just a minute or so about some of the work that your students are doing and how they work on capital punishment.
So our students do a number of different things in the project. They go out and interview witnesses. They assist in legal research and brief writing on behalf of indigent death sentenced inmates. I recently returned from an investigative trip with 4 of my students to South Carolina, where we're working on behalf of a man on death row there. So we try to give them an experience of what they would actually do as a lawyer if they were appointed to represent someone facing the death penalty or on death row.
So tomorrow, Charles Rines has a hearing where he's really challenging the drug protocol. Can you talk a little bit about that argument?
Well, there have been a number of different challenges to the lethal injection protocol and how it's been used in other states. As I understand it, his challenge is to the use of a single drug. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, yeah.
Yeah, that it's that. So I think really all of this stems from the fact that there has been this 3-drug protocol that has been used in a number of jurisdictions. There have been a number of cases where it seemed to clearly not work as it should. And now states are reacting to that and trying sort of different types of protocols. And I think the main challenge to most of them is that a fair amount of this is untested. And if you don't know sort of, you know, where the drugs come from, you know, who made them, because it's hard for states to get these from legitimate pharmaceutical companies to be used in execution. Drug companies don't want their drugs to be used in that. So if you're going to a compounding pharmacy or you're getting them through some other means, there's a significant risk the drugs won't work as intended, and that can lead to a horrific death. And that's kind of the essence of all of these lethal injection challenges.
And keeping where the drug comes from a secret, is that typically the norm?
There's been a lot of litigation about the secrecy. Some courts have required states to divulge this. Others have not. The Supreme Court of the United States has not yet taken this issue. I think they eventually will. Some states have dealt with this through statutes and transparency issues, but I think many people do find it troubling that someone is going to use a drug to kill someone and they don't have to tell you where they got it, who made it, and whether the person that made it was competent to do so.
What arguments work to get a stay of execution?
People have had, there have been some success with issues regarding the lethal injection methods and protocols that has, in some cases where there's a legitimate concern of the risk of a very painful execution, that has stayed. Significant new evidence, which the jury didn't hear, which has come to light since the last appeals process, can sometimes stays executions. But generally, at this point in the procedure, where he is in this, having sort of gone through what you would think of as the normal round of appeals, there's going to need to be something new that a court has not seen before that has some significance to the fairness of his conviction, sentence, or execution.
27 years has pretty much been a part of this appeal process. Is that a normal length of time?
It's on the longer side, the average length. I mean, we've seen people stay on death row, remain on death row, you know, longer and longer. The amount of time has gone up. But people have raised various Eighth Amendment challenges to under the cruel and unusual punishment clause to making someone serve this much time and then executing them. The idea is that you're sort of punishing them twice. They've really served what's the functional equivalent of a life sentence, and then you're going to execute them. Those have... to date, the Supreme Court of the United States has not decided to hear this. There have been a couple opinions from justices saying they think they should hear it. Justice Breyer, for example, has said on a number of occasions that he thinks this type of lengthy delay on death row before execution violates the Eighth Amendment. So I guess we'll have to wait and see.
What do we need to watch for in this final week here before a set date?
Well, I think I'm sure his lawyers are trying to make sure that there's nothing of significance that's new that the jury didn't know about. So I'm sure they're doing investigation in the case. They're obviously challenging this execution protocol and other things. And so I think the question really at this point is there going to be something that a court finds significant enough to stay the execution? Is the governor going to intervene in some way, given the vast power that governors have in the clemency process?
All right. John Bloom, I want to thank you so much for taking time and coming on the program today.
Sure,
I really
appreciate
it.
I appreciate the opportunity.